You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Dun, 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 dun. We interrupt this program from SFU to bring you this breaking news story from TIBC, the Truth in Broadcasting Corporation. From our world corporate headquarters in a secure underground location in Area 51 in Nevada, I'm Dick Veneer, your glib and banal anchor of Facade News. Facade News, the 24/7 newscast dedicated to keeping you in the dark. We go straight to the surface of a story and we stay there. No one can challenge our in-shallow reporting. We're dedicated to the highest standards of journalism. We deceive, you believe. Ladies and gentlemen, an amazing story coming across our news desk at this very moment. According to CFRO, an obscure radio station in Vancouver, they are reporting that Stephen Harper, John Baird, Peter Kent, Ezra Levant, Kevin O'Leary have been arrested for crimes against the environment and lying to the Canadian people. They were all found in locked embrace in a bunker under the Granville Street Bridge. With trillions of dollars in loonies, a stash of World Wrestling Federation DVDs, and a massive collection of Paul Anka CDs, and scores of unopened Papa John's pizza boxes. The arrests were made by a heretofore unknown group calling itself VULF, the Vancouver Liberation Front. Josh, a spokesperson for this so-called group, who refused to give his last name, incidentally, said, "This action is long overdue. We're dedicated to nonviolence and did not use force. But we had to act. We could no longer wait for Ottawa to enforce the law. They must face justice," he said, his voice rising in indignation. The prisoners in foot shackles and handcuffs, in orange jumpsuits, and with black cloaks over their head, were later reported to have defiantly shouted at their captors, "Do you know who we are? We are the masters of Canada." And then, inexplicably, each one of them burst into tears and said, "I want my mommy." If convicted, they will do time at Guantanamo. You'll recall the infamous U.S. prison that was returned to Cuban sovereignty on Christmas Day 2012. It looks like curtains for the former masters of Canadian politics. Their heads were bowed down as they were led away by blue-helmeted peacekeepers of VULF, the Vancouver Liberation Front, headed by Commander Kathy, who would also not give her last name. I'm Dick Veneer, your still glib and banal anchor of Facade News. Stay tuned to the TIBC network for updates on this breaking news story. Remember, we deceive, you believe. You either watch our news or you will be watched. And now back to our regularly scheduled program at SFU. Well, good evening, Vancouver. It's great to be here, and thanks to everyone who organized this and made it possible for me to be here. It's wonderful to be in this city, which I'm particularly attached to because of CFRO, that station that broke that story about all those Canadian politicians and journalists who have been arrested for lying to the people in this country. But CFRO, Co-op Radio, was one of the very first stations in all of North America to broadcast alternative radio, starting in 1986 when I started it in Boulder, Colorado. So there is that kind of electronic umbilical cord connection between Boulder, where I live, and Vancouver. Are all these people here for the free pizza and beer? Okay, this is how we can get a crowd in Vancouver on a rainy Friday night. Fortunately, the hockey strike is still on. And otherwise, I know what kind of turnout I would usually get, you know, in the high single digits, I think. Well, you have three huge monopolies here in Canada, dominating most of your media. You're better than the United States yet again. In the U.S., when I started this kind of work now some 30 years ago at a community radio station in Boulder, KGNU, there were about 50 corporations that control most of the media. And Ben Bagdikian, who is a great independent American journalist, wrote a book called The Media Monopoly, saying, you know, this is pretty dangerous for the communication needs of a democratic society to have that kind of concentration in the hands of 50 corporations. You know, this is not a good thing. Well, he wrote five or six subsequent editions to The Media Monopoly, and you can just trace the concentration and what's happened. 28 went to 23, 23 went to 14, 14 went to 10, 10 went to 6, and 6 went to 5. So right now there's 5. We're still behind Canada, but we're trying hard to have more and more concentration. Rupert Murdoch, you know, Australia's great gift to North American media, are there any Aussies out here? I'm sorry to offend you, is trying to take over yet more media outlets, and this is all being enabled by the left liberal socialist Barack Obama regime that we have in the United States. Well, Canada, of course, is in the news yet again because of its tremendous vote yesterday in the United Nations, joining such Pacific superpowers as the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Nauru, and Palau. I guess that must have cinched the deal for Harper and Baird. I mean, when you've got that kind of pressure, political, economic, and military on Ottawa, what else could they do but vote against Palestine at the UN? And there was, Foreign Minister Baird saying, this resolution will not advance the cause of peace, and it will hurt the peace process. Well, breaking news, John, there is no peace process. There is colonization, there is blockage of trade, there is there are all kinds of restrictions on Palestinians. It's whatever Washington decides to call the peace process that is the peace process. It's wonderful when you're the master of the universe and the king of the world or queen of the world. You define the territory. And so the peace process is in itself absolutely dead on arrival. The Palestinian state, what remains of it, is about 20% of original Palestine, and that too is shrinking, if we're to believe a report published in today's very subversive New York Times, that there will be a huge increase in what are euphemistically called settlements in the U.S. Corporate media. I don't know if you use that term here. In Canada, I think, Orwell was right. When you can obfuscate meaning, you can control the lexicon and control the political debate. So who's against settlements? You want to settle, right? It seems perfectly natural. The American West was settled by brave, mostly white European colonizers who, of course, encountered Native Americans who conveniently got out of the way. I mean, maybe you have similar kinds of stories here in Canada. And we saw also that in the Times, using language again today, and of course you can go to, Chomsky and people like George Lakoff and George Orwell to see how a language is used to frame and control the debate. Settlements is one example. Peace process is anything that the U.S. proposes. That's the peace process du jour. And on and on. In fact, here in the New York Times, which is our most prestigious and most excellent newspaper, these new settlements, I would put colonies there, would be more accurate, are just an expansion of existing Israeli neighborhoods. Well, that's again sounds something really wonderful. We all live in neighborhoods, right? But Palestinians live in strongholds. They're led by hardline leaders who are implacable, who are unreasonable. We see the same kind of discourse surrounding any mention of Iran in the corporate media in the United States. It's a hardline, it's a regime ruled by leaders who have no regard for international law, as if the embedded assumption is the U.S. has regard for international law. I mean, that's a rich one. That would make a lead story every night on Dick Vanier's Facade News. See, Dick's not that far off the mark. I mean, I think, you know, we need to inject humor in political discussions as a way of amplifying and illuminating what I think are truths. That's why in the U.S. at least, young people in great numbers get their news and information not from ABC, CBS, NBC, MSNBC, or NPR or PBS, but from the Jon Stewart Show, Comedy Central, and Steve Colbert. People learn more about their society, the political economy of capitalism, and although they don't use the word imperialism too much, in fact, not at all, I think they get an allergic reaction. A lot of Americans get the hives when you use the word imperialism to describe U.S. foreign policy, which I think, quite frankly, is a very fair description of what U.S. foreign policy is actually about, minus the propaganda, of course, the propaganda being we're interested in humanitarian intervention, women's rights, women's liberation. The U.S. invades Afghanistan because it's concerned about Afghan women. As Arundhati Roy, the great Indian writer, said at the time, it might be the first time in history that the U.S. Marines have been described as on a feminist mission. And it's in the U.S. political discourse, I don't know about Canada, it's always about defense. We're bringing democracy to the benighted natives, liberation, we're bringing the free market, all of these things. And we're always defending ourselves against a host of enemies that surround us, as Canada is surrounded by enemies who may strike at any moment. That's why you need to buy as many F-35s as you possibly can afford. You know, break the bank in Ottawa and defend yourself against impending attack from Sierra Leone, Bangladesh. I've seen already the military plans. They're going to move quickly in the middle of the night, and before you know it, you'll be speaking Bangla. That, of course, is how political discourse is structured very much in the U.S. I suspect it's not terribly different here in Canada. One example, of course, the most glaring example of this kind of media bias can be seen in any discussion on the Middle East. And, of course, the Middle East has a certain natural resource that attracts Washington. I leave it to your imaginations. Cauliflower, broccoli, some people say Brussels sprouts. There's a lot of controversy about it. But it might be oil, which the U.S. described the oil of the Middle East in the mid-1940s, when it became apparent that the United States was going to win World War II and emerge as the supreme economic and military power, that Franklin D. Roosevelt, president at the time, told the State Department to just map out what the post-war world would look like. We want to see what areas are we interested in controlling. It's a straight-out manifesto for global hegemony domination, but you don't use those words. You use words like free market and spreading freedom and liberty and things like that. And the State Department at the time described the oil of the Middle East as a stupendous source of strategic power and the greatest material prize in world history. It's a direct quote. And the corollary of that was, and we're going to get it. So all the rhetoric about freedom, about democracy, is just that. It's propaganda, they're vacuous terms. It is about controlling the resources of other countries and extracting as much as possible in terms of copper, bauxite, iron ore, manganese. But crucially, oil was seen as the engine of the global economy, and anyone that controlled the oil, of course, would rule the world. Gore Vidal, who died about a year ago, is a great essayist and historian. He called the United States the USA, the United States of amnesia. You know, ask Americans what they know about their own history. I mean, forget about Iran. I mean, that's exotic. Just ask them about, you know, their own political situation or what the U.S. is doing around the world, and you'll find, sadly, an enormous amount of disinformation, slogans that are repeated that, you know, really obfuscate and block any kind of reality. And I think, you know, as Chomsky points out, historical amnesia is dangerous. Why? Because not only because it undermines moral and intellectual integrity, but it lays the groundwork for crimes that lie ahead. So with this pattern of behavior, of invasions, of subverting other regimes, of overthrowing other governments, of, in fact, carrying out campaigns against democracy, the media play an absolutely central role in manufacturing consent. And, you know, speaking of Chomsky, he points out in this book I have this evening, How the World Works, you know, that the origins of capitalism and the economic system, at least in the United States, go back to the founding fathers. You know, not these people that Reagan compared to the founding fathers, but the actual founding fathers, who in the U.S. we're taught were semi-gods. These were not ordinary mortals. You know, they did not go into the bathroom the way we go to the bathroom. They don't get up in the morning the way we get up. They were clearly from another planet, these wonderful people that brought us the United States and liberation from British rule. But the origins of the economic system go back to those very people, particularly James Madison, for example, one of these pillars of integrity and moral rectitude. James Madison was a two-time president of the United States. He was the principal writer of the Federalist Papers, along with Alexander Hamilton, just one of these giants. He was asked, what was the aim of government? He said very clearly, the aim of government is to protect the opulent minority against the majority. The aim of government is to protect the opulent minority against the majority. That is the 1% versus the 99%. The very slogan, the very structure that the Occupy movement, of course, now has implanted into public consciousness in the United States in particular. I don't know enough about the internal economic situation in Canada, whether you have the grotesque income inequality that we experience in the United States, which has just simply gone off the charts, particularly since the 1980s, when Reagan in the U.S. and Maggie Thatcher in the U.K. Introduced this kind of neoliberal agenda, but it has produced extremely negative economic outcomes for millions and millions of ordinary Americans who have lost their jobs or who are working double shifts just to try to make ends meet. They're, you know, undergoing all kinds of sacrifices. They can't send their kids to school because our tuitions are skyrocketing, because we have to maintain a gold-plated weapons systems around the world. Over $1.1 trillion is spent on the U.S. military every year. That's to keep, of course, the world free for democracy. But as Michael Parenti, someone who I've featured on alternative radio multiple times, has pointed out, you know, it's not, the U.S. is not keeping the world safe for democracy. It's keeping it safe for hypocrisy. And let me just get a little bit of water here. So Madison said that about the role of government. His colleague, John Jay, who was the first president of the Constitutional Congress and also one of these founding fathers, he was the first Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, he said straight out, those that own the country ought to govern it. And that has pretty much been the way things have gone down in the U.S. But what has happened in the last 30 years has taken a particularly sharp turn. And that's what this book is about, Occupy the Economy, which I did with Richard Wolff, who's a radical economist that I met about a year ago. It's a very new book. And I was very impressed with his ability to explain economics in a non-academic in non-academic terms. So I call him a non-academic academic. And he gives, you know, wonderful examples about, you know, how the economic system really works in the U.S. For example, he uses, and I use, the rotten apples versus rotten barrel kind of description. So we're constantly bombarded during this economic crisis, which is now going into its sixth year in the United States, that it's the fault of a few greedy, avaricious, you know, manipulators, hedge fund, you know, owners and equity fund owners on Wall Street. If we just get rid of those guys, then the barrel is just great. Ignoring the fact that the problem is the barrel itself. It's the capitalist economic system that is constantly producing these kinds of negative outcomes, enormous concentrations of wealth and inequality, and particularly not just income inequality, but wealth inequality. That, too, has just skyrocketed off the charts in the United States. And Wolf talks about that. So income inequality is pretty straightforward. You know, you earn $50,000 a year, and I earn $55,000. So that's pretty reasonable. You know, just $5,000 difference in our incomes. But then I learned that this gentleman over here has a private jet. He has a private pilot. He has homes and condos in Montreal or Montreal or in Ottawa and Paris. He has a condo. He owns property in New York. He has huge investments in the New York Stock Exchange. He owns equity funds and hedge funds. He has memberships in golf clubs in all over Vancouver. He owns several yachts. In fact, he owns a marina. He owns Granville Island. This is wealth that is absolutely, you know, beyond the pale. And that, too, has skyrocketed very much in the last 30 years. All the while being, you know, celebrated in the media. These are people who are working hard, you know, who wake up every morning, you know, they put their shoes on, they go to work, and they, you know, they've earned their money. But we see that, you know, the economic system, since the end of World War II, has produced 16 economic, what they call downturns, another euphemism, downturn, economic crash or collapse. This one, which started in December of 2007, is the most acute, the most severe since the Great Depression of the 1930s. You know, sometimes the hardest thing to see is right in front of your nose. And it was a World Bank vice president. I mean, these are not people noted to be radical in any way. Ismail Sarageldin of Malaysia, he warned, this is about a decade ago, he said, well, the wars and conflicts in the past, they were about gold and silver, and right now it's about oil, but in the 21st century, it's going to be about water. And it's very much connected to capitalism. Capitalism, which is an economic system in its DNA, which has to expand. It is, as your own John McMurtry, who I think teaches at Guelph University, has written, we are in the cancer stage of capitalism. He says that capitalism is like a tumor. It is constantly expanding and will ultimately eat its host. Not because it dislikes its host or has some animosity, but this is what it has to do. It has to consume. And so we're on this treadmill of more and more jobs and growth and economic expansion without recognizing what this model of economic expansion is doing to terra firma, to our Mother Earth right here. You know, this precious planet, what Carl Sagan called this pale blue dot in the universe, you know, that's really in many ways on pins and needles. We continue to talk about business as usual, and we can't. and political leaders who say, yes, this is going to be the model and we're going to go forward and we're going to exploit the tar sands and we're going to, you know, extract shale and we're going to have fracking and we're going to have more natural gas and we'll be energy independent. They're talking about runaway, voracious corporate capitalism, which has no respect, does not honor the environment. The environment is something to be exploited, to be looted and plundered, not to be nurtured, which is what we should be doing. I mean, do many of you have plants or flowers in your homes or gardens, if you're lucky enough? You know, don't you look at those plants? Don't you give them water? Don't you give them sunlight? Well, maybe that's a problem here sometimes. But, you know, maybe turn on the overhead lights and pretend it's the sun. But, you know, we need to do that. We need to nurture the earth, not rip it to shreds. Resources are finite. They are going to end. In the process of accumulating more and more wealth, this economic system is destroying the planet. It's in its DNA. It has to do that. And that, let me go back then to the rotten apples and rotten barrel analogy that I mentioned earlier. Because in the U.S., you know, we're bombarded with this. Well, it's these, you know, few rotten apples. Like, you heard of Bernie Madoff? Right, a Wall Street, financier who ripped off, you know, orphans and grandmothers and, you know, people who didn't have much money and stole everything. You know, an awful guy, you know, and everybody was beating their breasts. What a terrible man. You know, how horrible. How could he do that? You know, let's put him in jail. And he is in jail now. Well, there's a whole series of these Bernie Madoffs. There's another guy who runs the Galleon hedge fund in New York. His name is Raj Rajaratnam. He was convicted of insider trading. Insider trading, by the way, in American capitalism, I'm sure it doesn't happen in Canada, is widespread and pervasive. You know, I find out, you know, from my friend who's the CFO or the manager of another corporation, that their profits are going to, they're going to issue a report tomorrow saying that their profits are going to increase 50%. And so I'm going to buy that stock today because I got that tip and I'm going to make lots and lots of money. It is a widespread practice in U.S. particularly in Wall Street. So Raj Rajaratnam got these tips from, it turns out, another guy who was a Goldman Sachs executive, much as Carney was a Goldman Sachs executive, soon to be head of the Bank of England, I believe. He got promoted from Ottawa to London. And they made tons of money, and now, you know, they were prosecuted and convicted. But we don't look at the barrel that keeps producing these people. So, you know, a couple of decades ago, it was Ken Lay of Enron. Before that, it was Michael Milken, this junk bond guy on Wall Street, or it was Ivan Boesky. You know, there's always these rotten apples. We never talk about the barrel, the system that keeps producing these apples. And that, I think, goes to the core of what Marx said, that capitalism has a werewolf hunger for profits. That's what it's about, like a werewolf. You know, it is bloodthirsty, it is voracious, it is rapacious, and it will do anything to maximize gain and to increase profits. That's what it's about. And that's, you know, that is going to continue unless there's a major turnaround in North America, in Europe, in the industrialized countries. And I, quite frankly, I don't see that happening from the top, and I don't expect it to come from the top. It's got to come from you. It's got to come from below. I don't know about Canada, but the only way social change has ever happened in the U.S. is from movements from below, not from some great leader, usually a white man, waking up in the morning in the White House and saying, you know, slavery is really bad. We got to do something about this. Or, you know, women not having the right to vote. This is not good. Things like, it always has come from pressure from below. It's what Howard Zinn, our great radical historian, said. It doesn't matter so much who's in the White House. It's who's outside the White House, protesting, demonstrating, making noise, getting in the face of people with power that really matters. Now, in the U.S. economic system, particularly, there has been a tremendous integration of state and corporate power. So really existing capitalism, as it's practiced in the United States, has very little to do with Adam Smith or David Ricardo or the traditional gods of capitalism that are always invoked by people who have never read them. That's crucial. You hear a lot about the invisible hand. Smith mentions it once in this gigantic book called The Wealth of Nations. He's routinely trotted out by pundits in the media to justify the current economic system. Yet the Smith that is represented bears little resemblance to reality. If he were around today, he probably would be appalled at the way his name and ideas are being bandied about. All that stuff about free market and entrepreneurial spirit and, bring yourself up by the bootstraps and tighten your belt and all those kinds of slogans that we're bombarded with prevent people from understanding how the U.S. economy really works. Actual capitalism relies on tremendous government intervention. There's hardly a sector of the U.S. economy that does not benefit from taxpayer largesse. Now, I'm sure that doesn't happen here in Canada. I just happened to drive by your, football stadium, or what was that? BC Place, where I understand you generously gave hundreds of millions of dollars so that it could be built. But that's probably the exception. But in the U.S., it's the rule. And so some of the biggest corporations, like, where did the internet come from? Oh, I know. Answer, I'm smart. Answer, Bill Gates, working in his garage in Palo Alto, invented the internet. What? That's not how it happened. The internet was invented by the Pentagon through its DARPA program, D-A-R-P-A, that's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, at public expense. We paid for it, and then mysteriously, once it's developed, it somehow finds its way into the private sector. The same thing happens with medicines. And vaccines. We have four national institutes of health in the United States that do, this is considered like the creme de la creme of medical research. They're the ones coming up with these vaccines and, cancer-curing medicines and the like. All paid for by the U.S. public. And then when these medicines and vaccines are developed, they somehow find their way over into Pfizer and Smith, GlaxoSmithKline, and the other big conglomerates. In sector after sector, almost without exception, there is massive public intervention. That's really existing capitalism, not the capitalism that's taught at Harvard University or Princeton or the University of California at Berkeley. They still peddle the myths and the fantasies about, the entrepreneurial spirit of Americans and how they are able to reinvent themselves. Now, I was in San Jose, California on September 11th, and there was a front page headline, Will This Wound Ever Heal? And it was a picture of the front page photograph of the World Trade Center. I'm sure some of you may have seen that. It's an image that keeps coming up over and over again. And the question posed by the headline writers, will this wound ever heal? The answer to that is never. It will never heal. It will not be allowed to heal because the U.S. uses September 11th as a way to justify intervention, expansion of power around the world, occupations, drone attacks, all in the name of course, freedom and democracy. So it's a very, in some ways, it's a grotesque propaganda system because it should be so obvious to people. But for a propaganda system to be really effective, it goes, it's kind of like it's in the aquifer. And so it's not readily seen by a lot of people because it's just embedded in the public discourse. So right now in the U.S., we're having these great media debates. You heard about the election. There was an election there more like an auction. $6 billion were spent on this auction. And there's a couple of things to say. The worst didn't happen. We didn't get the absolute, you know, horror of Romney, but we got Obama. And there, of course, there are differences within the, you know, capitalist economic system and within the political system in the United States. So, yes, you know, Romney is cyanide. You know, if you take it, you'll die instantly. And so you don't want to die instantly, right? You want to say goodbye to your friends, write a few checks, you know, tend to your affairs. That's why you go for the other candidate who's arsenic, Obama. Now, you can live for, you know, with good medicines, paid for the public trough through the National Institutes of Health. You could live for months. Of course, you'll be in, you know, very uncomfortable, but, you know, maybe you'll celebrate a birthday, see your grandson graduate from college or whatever, and so people voted for the lesser of two evils. That's what we're left with now, almost in every instance in the U.S. Political scene. But one thing is very consistent, and that is U.S. foreign policy. There's virtually no daylight between either of these two parties. In fact, one is more extreme than the other. So you have, you know, political debates about, you know, will an attack on Iran be effective in the media? This is a discussion on CNN or on National Propaganda Radio, which is our CBC, also known as NPR, you know, on Some Things Considered, you know, a very prestigious news program broadcast in the U.S. You know, it's kind of like I'm Peter Mansbridge and this is the National. You know, very serious people, right? I mean, they speak English. They don't yell. They have command of adverbs and adjectives. It's quite impressive. You know, because it's very easy for us to rant and rail about Fox, right? I mean, we can all be very self-righteous. We should be looking at the more liberal, serious media, you know, that has such a, that really is are the organs of the ruling class. I guess Canada probably doesn't have a ruling class, but in the U.S. we have a ruling class. You know, there is a group of people that basically own the economy. Let's call them the 1%. They got bailed out. We got sold out. Another Occupy slogan, which I think was very trenchant. The big banks and the people who own the banks, Wall Street, were bailed out by we the people. Because capitalism had to be saved. The capitalist ship was going down. Even though, you know, many of these people had committed great financial crimes, not a single person responsible for the economic collapse has even faced prosecution, much less jail time. I mentioned, you know, Bernie Madoff and Rajaratnam, but they weren't responsible. They're not the bankers. They're not the owners of the Wall Street banks. They're not J.P. Morgan Chase. They're not Bank of America. They're not Wells Fargo. They're not, there's one other. We now have four banks that basically control all banking in the U.S. I think this is going to become really easy in a couple of years. We'll have one media company, we'll have one bank, we'll have one pharmacy, we'll have one funeral home. It'll make our lives easier. You know, we could just write checks, funeral home. We don't have to say which one because there's only one. This is on the horizon, this kind of concentration and monopoly control, which is, I think, really harmful to the communication needs of a democratic society. If we call ourselves, you know, part of a democratic society, there's still that rhetoric in the U.S. that we are part of a democratic society. And it was seen, you know, very early on that for that kind of society to flourish, you would need a wide spectrum of opinion, right? From A to Z. See how I adjust for Canada? Thank you. I was given a vocabulary test before I landed, also to say hockey. And So yeah, that's exactly what, you know, what's going on. We don't talk about, you know, the system. We talk about the malefactors, the people who rip off the system, and the system itself gets a free pass. There's a wonderful example that Wolf uses in the book of a refrigerator, right? So let's say I come to your home. Your refrigerator's on the fritz. It hasn't been working. So I come in, I say, look, lady, you know, this condenser you got over here, you know, it's not working. This is going to cost you about $6,000 to replace. And you know what? We don't even have it in stock. We got to order it from China. It's probably going to take 2 or 3 months before it gets here. Now I'm looking at this ice-making machine you have here. You know, that's broken too, but I'm not an electrician. I got to get an electrician to fix that. You know, I'll have to call him in. And then it looks like you got mice here because all your wiring has been chewed at and it's not working at all. You know, lady, this isn't going to be worth any of your money to replace. You know, why don't you just think about getting to fix? Why don't you think about changing the way you keep your food, safe? You know, change the system. Don't keep making cosmetic repairs to systemic problems. This is another key point, I think, of this book, Occupy the Economy. The U.S. system has a wonderful way of reinventing itself. Okay, you know, there's a crisis. Don't worry. We'll pass some legislation. We'll put a couple of people in jail. You know, we'll make them kind of, examples. And then we'll move on, you know. That's not going to work. It is not working in terms of actual existing capitalism, not the capitalism that I refer to, the mythological capitalism that we actually have. You know, like that well-known substance, capitalism has hit the fan, and it's time to be thinking about alternatives. And again, you know, the role of the media, the role of propaganda in manufacturing consent, as well as criminalizing dissent. So people who are speaking out against imperialism in the United States and capitalism are being criminalized. We're being put in jail. We're not being allowed to speak. We're being deported from countries. All kinds of restrictions are being placed on dissent. We saw that with the brutality that the state security forces crushed the Occupy movement beginning in November of 2011, a scant 2 months after it started, actually heeding a call from someone here in Vancouver. By the way, you probably know about Adbusters and the suggestion that Adbusters put out, I think in July, to go down Wall Street and pitch your tents and occupy. And that was the germ, the seed of this Occupy movement, which is now currently in kind of stasis mode. But we saw during the Frankenstorm in New York that at least in New York, the Occupy movement has played a very active role in providing food and care, particularly to the elderly and the infirmed in those storm-affected areas. So that's a very concrete example of the Occupy movement, doing very constructive work and work that is needed badly. I mentioned about, you know, now Iran is, you know, the great enemy, and that means the West, whatever that means, the U.S. may have to attack Iran, or Israel may attack Iran, or both countries will attack Iran because it poses such a great threat. And I'm sure Stephen Harper and Ottawa will be, you know, cheering along any military action. I can't blame Harper. I mean, I'm staying here in English Bay, and I could look out and I saw an Iranian submarine surface right off your coast. I mean, the brazenness of it in broad daylight. They're everywhere. Iranian aircraft carriers were spotted off of right outside of San Francisco just a week ago. I'm glad you laughed because, you know, in the U.S. audiences, sometimes people don't laugh because they believe, well, Iran is really dangerous, you know. Iran, Iran is a great threat to, you know, international peace. And, you know, I'm not saying that the regime in Tehran is, you know, anything to, to applaud, but they are the current enemy du jour, the current justification of this enormous military machine that we have in the United States, to the tune of, as I mentioned, $1.1 trillion a year, while we have close to 25 million U.S. citizens without work. 14 million people have lost their homes. About 10 million are in danger of losing their homes. There are acute economic problems, you know, and it's kind of like living in ancient Rome. You know, we see, you know, we're fed bread and circuses, you know, we're fed Hollywood divorces and the Kardashian sisters and this or that. And, we, you know, we have a media that functions as a weapon of mass distraction. And there's, you know, all the actual record, the reality of U.S. policy is completely obscured from many people. So much of what is processed in the corporate media has in it embedded ideas. For example, the U.S. has the right to invade any country at any time for any pretext. That's not even challenged. That's never even spoken about. What is spoken about will be the tactics. So this is a debate, and I've seen this on CNN with Anderson Cooper. This is a debate on CNN. Will an attack on Iran be effective? And then, you know, then there's the discussion. Well, if the U.S. uses bunker buster bombs and daisy cutters, you know, it could be effective. But I think, you know, ultimately we've got to put boots on the ground. And, well, do you think that'll work? You know, will what kind of resistance will there be? So already you're in the logic of military action. Aggression is perfectly fine. The discussion is about how you do it. You know, should it be in conjunction with Israel? Should Israel go alone? You know, how should it be carried out? It becomes a discussion about tactics, and all the embedded ideas are never challenged at all. I mean, international law, when any U.S. Politician, Hillary Clinton or Obama, whenever they say that word, people should break out in laughter. Because the U.S. is constantly violating international law. It defines international law. So it can bomb Pakistan and Yemen, kill American citizens. It can bomb and occupy Afghanistan. It can, drone attacks, etc. That's all fine, but if anybody else should do it, you know, then international law is invoked. The UN Security Council should be called in. I mean, it's pretty, you know, you really have to take your hat off to the intellectual class and the media in the United States for, you know, how they're so disciplined in keeping this information or keeping this analysis from the American people. Now, I want to close, you should never say that, because as a Gemini, I'm constantly distracted and interrupt myself with new things. But I just wanted to show you how the propaganda system really hasn't changed over the last 20, 25 years. These are cover stories from two major U.S. magazines, Time and Newsweek. There is this one, Muslim Rage, and the other one is called Agents of Outrage. I have kept all copies of these magazines with these types of covers and very inflammatory headlines, screaming headlines, you know, angry Muslims and ferocious Arabs and, you know, what's wrong with Islam? You know, Christians can kill tens of millions of people. No one asks a question, what's wrong with Christianity? There can be, you know, mass murder of Hindus in Sri Lanka by Buddhists. Nobody asks what's wrong with Buddhism or what is it in Buddhism that provokes this. We see now Muslims under attack by Buddhists in Myanmar. or Hindu nationalists that kill Muslims in Kashmir. No one writes books like Bernard Lewis, you know, he wrote a book, What's Wrong with Islam? What's Wrong with Hinduism? It's about Islam, because Islam is tied to oil and the Middle East and to U.S. hegemony and control of oil. So there's all of this attention on this particular group, and you know, you find these kinds of things. We don't learn why these people are angry. Apparently it's something in their genes, or maybe it's in the Holy Quran, you know, but we never hear about, well, could it be U.S. foreign policy? Might drone attacks on wedding parties in Pakistan. I've been to Pakistan multiple times. You know, I've talked to people that have been bombed. Very unpleasant experience. I don't find it, you know, I don't think you'll find it edifying if you're bombed in the middle of the night or your school or your mosque. People, they have funny ideas. They kind of don't like that. And so they naturally, you know, feel some antipathy or antagonism toward the beacon of freedom of democracy in Washington. So this has been a steady trope over the last 20 or 25 years. Always angry Muslims screaming. They're incoherent. They're oversexed. They have too much money, of course. And there's no examination of the things that may be contributing to this anger. I think poetry is a wonderful way to end a tirade. That's what it is. That's what you've been subjected to here on Facade News. I want to start with, I'm sure there's tons of Urdu speakers here in the audience. The greatest Urdu poet of the 20th century is Faiz Ahmed Faiz. He was a journalist and proud of it. He was a union man and proud of it. He was a Red and proud of it. He spent many years in jail, put in jail by U.S.-backed dictators like Ayub Khan and Ziaul Haq. He died in 1984, I think. But his most famous poem is called Bol. Bol is the imperative to speak. And in demonstrations in India that I've attended, people have signs in Devanagari script that say, you know, Bol. Bol ke lab azad hai tere. Bol zuban ab tak teri hain. Speak, your lips are free. Speak, your tongue is still yours. This magnificent body is still yours. Speak, your life is still yours. Speak, there is little time. But little though it is enough time. Enough before the body perishes, before the tongue atrophies. Speak, the truth still lives. Say what you have to say. Speak, your lips are free. Bol. Faiz Ahmed Faiz. Thank you, thank you. Those were my opening remarks. I'd like to get... I have my formal presentation. Bob, I've studied... I worked on this for hours. All right, you'll have to go with just what I said.
Yeah.